Last week we finished Job, and we saw that Job was a story that allows us to see what goes on behind the scenes, so to speak. We saw a glimpse into heaven and how God's interacting with these principalities and powers in the heavenly places who are looking at us to understand about God. And we saw that Job, who was God's favorite guy and a righteous guy, even though he knew a lot about God, he called it from as the hearing. Once he really understood who God was, it was total life-changing the way he saw himself. And we saw that it to all appearances seems that God thought it in Job's best interest to let Job go through great difficulty in order to see that lesson. And that this life is a one-time opportunity to know God by faith. And if we know God by faith, we will have a reward forever that can't be replaced. The principalities and powers can't know God by faith. They're stooping down to see us because only we can do that. And we'll only be able to do that for a short time, and it's this life. James calls it a wisp of vapor. It just doesn't last very long. Sometimes, I guess, when you're with certain people, it seems like it's lasting too long. But you know, life is short, but it's so impactful. Well, we have it built in our hearts to know that this is really important. Life is important. And we have a great desire to be important. You can see that in our culture with the self-esteem movement. The self-esteem movement is a very silly and ridiculous way to get at a very appropriate need. Just think about it logically. The notion that I can elevate myself is kind of a silly notion. I can forgive myself. I can elevate myself. If that's really true, you wouldn't really need anybody else. And the self-esteem movement is kind of a way to deal with our interaction with other people. Well, you know, that's kind of a silly way to deal with that. But there's a real genuine need we have to say we're important. Well, it turns out we really are. Look at Revelation 1. Revelation 1:6. And he's talking about, let's start with 4, John to the seven churches which are in Asia. Grace to you and peace from him who is and who was and who is to come. So this is a letter from Jesus. And from the seven spirits who are before the throne. This is an authoritative message. And from Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead and the ruler over the kings of the earth. Be hard to get a more important message than this. To him who loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood, and has made us kings and priests to his God and Father. Well, that's pretty important, don't you think? That Jesus is telling us, I made you a king and a priest. He says it again in 5:10. And has made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. Well, that's a pretty high and lofty position. But it's not high and lofty because we've elevated ourselves. It's high and lofty because God has made it that way. And He's the most high and lofty thing. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about two kings. We're in this series on great characters of the Bible. And we're going to look at Saul and David, two kings. And what we're going to be looking at is, what kind of king should we be? He's made us to be kings and priests. It says it right here. What kind of king we should be. Now, there's a little bit of a cosmic element in this as well. Because although God made us to reign on the earth, we're not actually doing it right now. We've looked before at the book of Hebrews. And Hebrews is written to a group of believers. They're called holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling. They're very familiar with the writer, who I think is Paul, who says to them, you know, pray for me. I appreciate so much that in former times, when I was in my chains, you ministered to me. You weren't ashamed of my chains. And you lost your possessions and were glad. And you've done good works and you're still doing good works. You holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling. I mean, these are pretty stout people. But then he also says you've kind of lost your hearing and you should be moving on to maturity. Instead, you're going back to elementary things. And the elementary things he focuses on is religious practice. You've started thinking that religious practice is the focal point when it's just information to point you to the real thing. So the earthly priests, I mean, they're Jews, so they went to the Levitical priests and stuff. Nothing wrong with that. They're not there as an end unto themselves to say, if I do this thing, then I can do what I want. They're there to point you to the big priest and the big king, the true king, that before whom you can cleanse your hearts from an unclean conscience to have good works. So that's kind of the point of Hebrews. And in this, he says, he quotes Psalm 8 that says, we were made to reign on the earth. That's what we were made to do. But it isn't happening right now. The earth is not in perfect harmony, and we as people are not in perfect harmony reigning over the earth. That's not happening right now. That's not what we see. What do we see? We see Jesus. And he is crowned as king for the suffering of death. That's what we see. And that suffering of death is paving the way for us to join him on his throne when he comes to claim the earth. So there's this gap. There's this gap where we are kings, but we're not on the throne yet. And Jesus came, and he showed us that, what that looked like. He's the king of the earth. But Pilate said, are you a king? Yeah, I'm a king. But my kingdom is not of this world. If it was, my followers would fight. But not right now. My kingdom is not of this world. He said, I came to serve. I came to obey my Father and totally depend on him. Apart from the Father, I can do nothing. And this is the king of the earth. The one who is sovereign over all. So there's a gap. There's a time period where we say, my kingly duty is to serve and follow during this time. And then there will be a time when I actually take the throne of authority. There's a gap. Now, this kingship is actually a reward. Look at Revelation 3. It's something he's given to us. But rewards can be lost. 2 John says, do not lose the reward that's laid up for you. You want a full reward. Don't listen to false teachers in that instance. And in chapter 3 of Revelation, in verse 21, he says to him who overcomes, who is a victor, I will grant him to sit with me on my throne as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. Jesus overcame. Now, Jesus did not accept Jesus into his heart. Jesus overcame temptation and did the will of his Father. And as a result, his name was lifted above every name, that every knee should bow and every tongue confess. And he wants us to share that. This is a reward. It's something that's already been granted to us. And it's for us not to lose. Well, we've got some choices to make. We are kings. The question is, what kind of king are you going to be? Or what kind of queen are you going to be? What kind of royalty are you going to be? There's two kinds. There's the earthy kind. The earthy kind is evidenced by the character Saul. And an earthy king makes the rules, decides what is true, in order to get the results they want from everyone else. They decide what's true. They decide what you need to hear. An earthy king demands their own way. Earthy king says, I must gain a certain result. It's for the good of all. Too bad if a few people have to die or be stomped or trampled on. But it's just the way it is. For us to have good, I must stay in power, and that's the most important thing. They focus on outcomes. They focus on results, earthy kings. I have to make this result happen. Why? Because I'm in charge. And it's my job to get this result to happen. An earthy king focuses on others serving them. And an earthy king focuses on retaining followers. I've got to get people to follow me. Well, What does a servant king do? That's what Jesus came and said. I came to serve. I'm washing your feet because that's what I want you to do. That's what kings do. That's what godly kings do. That's what servant kings do. So a servant king loves. What is in your best interest? A lot of times what's in your best interest or my best interest is to hear the truth. Truth is not something I decide what it is. Truth is truth. It's external to me. Servant kings serve with their gifts. No matter how it's viewed by other people. Washing feet, a very lowly thing? Doesn't matter. That's my gift. That's what I'm going to do for you. Servant kings don't focus on getting followers to follow. They focus on following. Servant kings follow God. And servant kings don't focus on getting other people to obey. They focus on obeying. So let's look at these things. Let's look at these great characters. Turn to 1 Samuel with me. We've got the characters of Saul and David. Saul and David were both anointed as kings at the same time. And they functioned for a good long while, both anointed as kings. One was sitting on the throne of power, Saul. One was waiting for the throne of power to be given to him. And both were kings. See the picture? There's somebody right now that's sitting on the throne of the power of this earth that's already been told, I'm taking the throne away from you. Who's that? It's Satan. And there's somebody else that's been anointed as king, us. We're waiting our turn. So you see the picture? 1 Samuel 13. So Saul reigned for a year, and he chose some men of Israel. And verse 5, the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, people like the sand on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped at Michmash to the east of Beth Avon. And when the men of Israel saw they were in danger, for the people were distressed, and the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilgal. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. Then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. Samuel told him, go to Gilgal, wait for me for 7 days, and then I'll come and sacrifice. But Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and a peace offering here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, well, I saw the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days. And the Philistines gathered together at Michmash. And I said, man, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I've not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. Okay? I saw the people scattering. What do I have to do? I got to get them to follow me. We have to fight the Philistines. Okay? So, when things don't work out the way I'm instructed, then I need to change things. Because this isn't working out. I got to focus on the results, and I got to focus on followers. Samuel said to Saul, you've done foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. Isn't it ironic? What did he want? He wanted to secure his kingdom. So what did he do? He trusted his eyes. And he demanded that results come about. And what does God say? Look, I'm the one that gave you the kingship in the first place. I'm the one that's in charge of results, not you. Don't you get that? Why are you so focused on getting certain results? So that's an example of earthly kingdom. And he says here in 14, but now the kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander. So already Saul knows God's going to replace you. Now, that's the truth. But what we're going to do is see that Saul tries to make the truth his own way. Let's look at 14 and 24. So they continue to fight with the Philistines. And there's an episode where Jonathan starts a rout of the Philistines. And in verse 24, the men of Israel were distressed that day. The Philistines scatter and the Israelites are chasing them. But Saul had placed the people under an oath. And here was the oath. Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies. Now it turns out what had happened is they had gone through a forest and Jonathan had gone up to this garrison and started this rout. And they're running through the woods and Jonathan didn't hear the oath. And there was some honey laying on the ground. So Jonathan picked some up, ate it. He was refreshed. And the people didn't because of the oath, because of the curse. And they were basically famished. I mean, they're running all day. They're fighting all day. There's no food. So they run out of energy. And they can't continue. And Jonathan says, man, my dad was an idiot. What was he thinking here? If everybody would have had some of this honey, we could have had a much bigger rout. Well, then there's a problem. And they find out what is the problem. They take the lots and they find out Jonathan disobeyed the curse. So then Saul says, okay, whoever disobeyed the curse, you know, has to die. Turns out to be Jonathan. And Saul says, okay, let's kill Jonathan. So he's made everything about himself. I have to avenge myself on my enemies. What's he doing there? He's getting the people to follow him. And he's trying to consolidate his power over the people. And in doing so, what he does is he makes his nation weaker. And then, because he made this oath in the sight of the people, he's willing to kill his own son, his heir. And the people say, don't do that. Jonathan is the one that started the rout today. You can't have that happen. So only then does Saul say, okay, I'll let him off the hook. So again, it's what do the people think of me? I'm willing to do unthinkable things just to get people to follow me. I got to have followers and I got to have results. Earthy king. Let's look at 15, chapter 12. 1 Samuel, yeah, still 1 Samuel, 15, chapter 12. So Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, and it was told Samuel, saying, Saul went to Carmel. And indeed, he set up a monument for himself. So they had a victory, and what Saul does is he goes and sets a monument to himself. Why do kings set monuments for themselves? Yeah, so they can everybody will remember, wow, this is a powerful guy. It's a way of building up, of consolidating your power. Still, what Samuel's doing is he's focusing on, I must retain my possession that I have. He's not acknowledging, hey, God gave me this, he can take it away. He's not acknowledging what God told him. I'm going to take this away from you. He's getting the results himself. I must control. You know, earthy kings are all about control. Servant kings recognize there's really only three things you can control. Who you trust, your attitude or your perspective and the choices you make. That's all you can control. You cannot control results. I can't make other people think things, do things. I can only control who I trust. And most of the time what we tend to do is trust us in our own eyes. That's what Saul's doing here. Well, Saul is never rejected as a child of Israel. You know, being born into God's family is a gift we're given that's irrevocable. Just like physical birth is. You may wish you were never born. You may even take your own life. But you know what happens if you take your own life? You just wake up somewhere else. You can't undo that. You were born. Spiritual birth is the same way. Election into Israel is the same way. Once an Israelite, always an Israelite. But kingship's a reward. And that's something that can be taken away. And Saul's kingship was taken away. Let's just keep going. Start on 13. Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I've performed the commandment of the Lord." Okay, so that's a factual statement. God told me to do something, I've done it. But Samuel said, "What is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" What the Lord had commanded Saul to do is go and destroy the Amalekites and all of their possessions and take nothing, including the livestock. Samuel said, and Saul said, "They've brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen." Of course, to sacrifice to the Lord your God. So now, truth is not truth anymore. It depends on what the means now. Okay, we just have to spin this around. And well, I actually did do what the Lord said, because we destroyed everything that was not ours. I mean, we didn't take anything. Sorry, we destroyed everything that was the Amalekite, and we didn't take anything. We just segregated some stuff off for the Lord, and he'll eventually get that. We'll just kind of, you know, keep it for a while. And besides that, it was me you told, and I did what I was supposed to do, but the people didn't. You know, truth is a very nuanced thing in politics. "And the rest we've utterly destroyed." And Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet, and I'll tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said, "Speak on." And Samuel said, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel?" You didn't make this kingship because of anything that was intrinsic to you. I gave it to you. "And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them till they're consumed.' Why didn't you obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? You didn't do what I told you to. Servant kings follow." And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek." Yeah, he didn't say bring back, he said destroy. Well, you know, bring back, destroy. It's kind of the same. What? "I've utterly destroyed, but the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, not me. And the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord." It's okay. We had a good reason to do this. It was for the Lord. It was for His benefit. So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offering and sacrifice as obedience of the Lord?" Because of this, God took the kingdom away. However, not for a long time was Saul actually dispossessed. And he says, "I want a king that'll follow what I want him to do." So, we go to chapter 16. And we have David that's anointed as king. And you know this story. He has all these brothers, and he's the youngest. And they don't even bring him. He says, "Don't look at his appearance or his physical stature, because I've refused him," he says to these other guys. "But I look at the heart, and I want somebody that'll follow me." So he anoints David as king. And then, of course, you know that what's about to happen is there's a battle, another battle, again against the Philistines. And they go into this valley of Elah. And there's this giant that is Goliath. And David's anointed king now. So he's anointed king, and there's this big battle going on. And where is the king, the anointed king, while the big battle's going on? Tending the sheep back at the dad's house. Okay, so not a real kingly thing, but he's doing it. It's his job. And his dad says, "Take some provisions for your brothers who are out fighting." So he takes the provisions out. And he sees Goliath out there taunting, because they had this champion thing. You know, we'll have our champion, you have your champion, whichever champion wins, the other side will serve them. And, you know, Goliath's been defying Israel, and they don't really know what to do, because they don't have anybody that can fight this guy. He's huge. So David sees that, and he says, what'll be done for the man who'll fight Goliath? Look at 17:28, and this is really interesting to me, because his brothers were there when he got anointed king by Samuel. Here's what they think of that. Now, Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, David. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle." Now, do you hear anything there about what Eliab thinks of David's anointing? Does he really, "Hey, this is the king. I need to make sure, this is my brother, and he's the king. I need to get in good with my brother. He's the king." You hear any of that? What does he think about the anointing? He doesn't really give it any credence, right? And why should he? Right now, Saul is the king on the throne. And you have to actually believe that this anointing is real. You have to have faith it's true. Because there's nothing you can see that makes it. He's still just David the sheep tender, right? That's all I see. But David apparently took it as real. Because what we're going to see him do is behave as a real king in this circumstance. Now, what does David know? He's about to confront Goliath. We know that. What does he know? One is, he knows he's been anointed king. And kings serve. The second thing he knows, and he's been prepared for this moment. Look at 1735. Or let's see, 33. Let's go 33. 1733. And Saul said to David, "You can't go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're a youth. And a man of war from his youth. And he's a man of war from his youth. You don't know how to fight this guy. You don't have the skill. You know? In order to fight, you've got to have skills." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took the lamb out of the flock, I went out and struck it." Now, there's something going on here I think that we typically are going to miss that Malcolm Gladwell pointed out to us, that great theologian Malcolm Gladwell. This term "struck" is the Greek, is the Hebrew word nakah. It's the same word in verse 49 when it says, "Then David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead." How did he knock the lion down with the lamb in his mouth? Did he sprint after him? No, I don't think so. What he did is he got his sling out and whacked him in the head and knocked him senseless. And then he went over and he took the lamb out of the lion's mouth. And when the lion came to and tried to get him, he cut his beard and killed him. So what he's telling Saul here is, "I am a crackerjack slingshotter." Now, this was nothing new in Israel. Back in the Judges, there were all these left-handed guys in Benjamin. And it said they could hit a hare at a, what is it? Oh, I thought somebody's down. You know, they could hit a small target at a long distance. I forget exactly how they said it. But so this was part of modern ancient warfare. The slingshot guys, and the really good ones were crackerjack. And one of the things that David knew is that I can hit a little target that's on the move, and this is a big target that's standing still. And you wonder, why would Saul take the risk of letting David fight Goliath? Well, it's because David is coming in and saying, you know, there's a worldly way to look at this. And the worldly way is, you fight this battle on their terms. Because what does Goliath want? Hand-to-hand combat, right? But he didn't specify that. He just said, "Come and fight me." And David is coming in and saying, "Let's don't fight it on their terms. We'll fight it on our terms, and I'll go out after him with a slingshot." Gladwell says, the minute the slingshotter walks onto the battlefield, everybody knows what's going to happen. If he's good, Goliath is sunk. And Goliath even says, hey, he starts taunting him and says, "Come close to me." And David says, "You wish." We're not going to fight that this way. Saul at least tries to get David to wear some armor, and David says, "Yeah, this is all about movement, man. I gotta have my free motion because it's all about the accuracy." So he just does to the giant the same thing he had done to the lion and the bear. He knew he was anointed, and kings serve. Kings go out and courageously confront enemies on behalf of the people. Kings trust, servant kings trust God. Servant kings obey God. That's what servant kings do. Saul here, the earthy king, is hiding behind the anointed king. And of course, he doesn't know that guy's anointed at this point in time. The other thing that he knows is that the Lord is with him. Look at 37. Your 36. Your servants killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he's defied the armies of the living God. Moreover, David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." He knows who's in charge of results. That's what David knows. So David, here, two anointed guys, one earthy guy who's clutching to his kingship, who's trying to get followers, who's defining truth in his own way, who's focused on results, and we got the servant king, who knows what the gifts God's given him, is not worried about the results, even if he's the one that dies, and who understands things from God's perspective, and he's not doing things on the world's terms. He's doing things a totally different way. He's changing the rules. And of course, we know what happened. It's a big lumbering guy with a giant spear. And what? It's like a rifle against a baseball bat. David knocks him down and cuts his head off. Now, we have this myth that David is 12 years old or something. 12-year-old couldn't take Goliath's sword and chop his head off. Okay, he's probably 20 or something like that. You know, he's a powerful young man. But he's young. And he's not an experienced soldier. He is an experienced warrior. So David is the servant. We see this same attitude a little bit later after David is now on the run because Saul is trying to kill him because Saul realizes this is the guy that's going to take over my throne. Now, he's already had God tell him, "I'm going to find somebody after my own heart." He knows it's David. So instead of saying, "Okay, you know, whenever that happens, that's fine because God's in charge of the results." Instead, what he does is he says, "I'm going to kill that guy and make my way." Of course, anytime you start making truth yourself, you end up not knowing what truth is. And you end up very double-minded. For example, when David is in the process of finding out that I got to go on the run, there's this episode where David doesn't come to a feast on purpose to see if Saul gets mad, because he tells Jonathan, Saul's son, if he gets mad, that means he wants to kill me. And sure enough, that happens. And Jonathan tells Saul he didn't come because he asked for my permission to go to Bethlehem. And Saul, who wants to kill David so that Jonathan can be king, picks up his spear to kill Jonathan. See, it leads to craziness when we start defining truth ourselves. Well, we come to this cave, chapter 24. Now it happens, Saul is returned from following the Philistines. He was told, saying, "Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. You can go there today." It's still known where this is. It's near Masada, right down by the Dead Sea. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. Now, I've been here to this place, and I'll tell you, I don't know how you could name a place the rocks of the wild goats, because that's all there is in this. There's just rocks and wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. And Saul went in to attend to his needs. Now, they translated this, attend to his needs, the literal Hebrew is cover his feet, and it means go and relieve himself. So, you know, and usually in the movies, no one ever does this. Have you ever noticed that? But in real life, this is something you got to do. And David and his men happen to be in the latrine here. They're in the recesses of the cave. So he chose the one place to go relieve himself where all of David's men are. And then the men of David said to him, "This is the day which the Lord said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that may you do to him as it seems good to you." Now, God had anointed David as king, right? And he said, "You're the rightful king." Wouldn't it be totally rational to say, "This is how God has delivered the kingship into my hand"? It would be totally rational and completely defensible. So David arose and secretly cut a corner of Saul's robe. And it happened afterward, David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. And he said to his men, "Man, the Lord forbid I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed." Man, this guy's trying to kill him. He tried to kill him multiple times. But that's not what David was looking at. Because servant kings are great followers. And David is a servant king. He's a man after God's own heart. And what he says is, the Lord put this guy in, and he's anointed. I'm anointed. He's anointed. It's not up to me to decide when I take that throne. That's God's to decide. Now, isn't that awesome? A man after God's own heart. Look, God made all of us to be kings. Do you try to manipulate results instead of just trusting that God knows what He's doing with results? I do. This is one of the things we can get over. And you know what happens? I was talking to a friend recently who used to be an atheist. He said, "Man, being a Christian is so much less work than being an atheist." When I was an atheist, I thought I had to control the whole universe. And it's exhausting trying to control everything. And now that I realize God's in control of the universe, not me, and I can just trust Him for the results, I still work, but it's so much less trouble. Because now I can just focus on doing my job. Well, that's the servant king attitude. David is just focusing on doing his job. And he goes and tells Saul, and Saul says, "You're more righteous than me, and I know you'll take the kingdom." And then just goes away and keeps right on trying to kill David. And David knows good and well that's what he's going to do, but lets him go anyway. We see this basic mentality that David has after he has been king and he's deposed. So it's one thing to do this if you've never actually sat on the throne and have this attitude. But if you sat on the throne and then lost it, could you still have it? Well, let's look at where that actually happens. In 2 Samuel 15, that actually takes place. David, as you recall, sinned with Bathsheba and murdered her husband. And Nathan the prophet comes to David and says, "You did this in secret, but I'm going to cause division to come to you from within your own family, and I'm going to do this same thing to you in public." And sure enough, Absalom wins the heart of the people. There's a coup. He leaves Jerusalem. The ark comes with him. He leaves behind 10 concubines to keep the house. And Absalom has them set up a tent, and he goes into those concubines to do to his wives what he did to Bathsheba right out in plain view. And what they're doing there is Absalom saying, "I'm making myself so odious to David he can't forgive me. So this is not going. This is going to be me or him." That's according to his counselor Ahithophel. So he's deposed, and he's going up the Mount of Olives in 15:24, and there was Zadok the priest and all the Levites with him, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over from the city. So these are the people that are fleeing Jerusalem with David going up the Mount of Olives. Then the king said to Zadok the priest, "Carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, He'll bring me back and show me both it, the Ark, and His dwelling place, the tabernacle. But if He says thus, 'I have no delight in you,' here I am. Let Him do to me as He pleases." See, results are in the hands of God. I am the king, but I don't get to decide how things turn out. What I get to decide is how I'm going to serve. What I get to decide is whether I'm going to follow and do what God's asked me to do. And this is after he had done the Bathsheba thing, which was a horrible mistake. But he returns to his old heart, which is the servant king heart. You see here when this is a companion with the situation with Nathan, the prophet, when Nathan calls him out on what he did with Bathsheba, he doesn't shuck and jive like Saul did. You know, well, I didn't actually murder, you know, what's his name? Uriah. Yeah, I didn't actually murder Uriah. For some reason, I thought Uriah, and then I went into Uriah Heep and David Copperfield, and I thought, this isn't David Copperfield. It's funny how your mind works. And so he says, you know, he could have said, I didn't really murder him. You know, that happened out on the battlefield. But he took responsibility for his actions and repented. And now he says, if I find favor in the LXX, the Septuagint, this word favor is the Greek word charis, grace. If I find grace in that, favor just means someone looks at a situation and says, I like that situation. And anytime God does it, he does it for his own reasons, not because of some external standard. And David understands that. God is going to decide this, not me, because he is a servant king. So what kind of king are we going to be? Are we going to be an earthy king that tries to control? Are we going to be an earthy king that makes our own truth, that parses, you know, nuances to justify what we wanted the outcome to be? Are we going to be the kind of king that tries to get others to serve us, the earthy king? Are we going to be an earthy king that focuses on getting people, what do I have to do to get people to follow me? Are we going to be a servant king? Are we going to be focused on what's actually true and what reality is? Are we going to serve with our gifts? Are we going to walk in obedience to the great king and focus on being a great follower? That's what a servant king does. And what God has promised us is, if you'll love me, if you'll have a heart for me like David had a heart for me, I have in store for you things you have never seen, things you've never heard, and things that haven't even entered into your heart. If I explained it to you, you couldn't understand it, how wonderful this is, what I have for you. And I want to share it with you. Just trust me. This life, as we learned in Job, this life is short. And it's the only opportunity you get to be a king by faith. This is it. No faith in the next world. You can't have faith in what you see. And if you'll take that opportunity and embrace it, I'll make you a real king with me on my throne as your reward. It's pretty spectacular. But it's a lot easier to do things the world's way. It's a lot easier to look at a Goliath and say, I have to fight that on my turn, on the world's terms, and it'll eat me. What's a Goliath in your life? What can you look at and say, I don't have to look at that the world's way. I can look at it through God's eyes, and it can't stand. It can't stand me if I do. I'm prepared to knock this down. What is that? Is that the thing that's standing in the way of you being a servant king? We're all called to be Davids. We don't have to convince ourselves we're important. We can trust God that what we have to do is really important. And a Goliath for us can be something very, very simple. Most of the time, the things God asks us to do seem trivial in the eyes of others, right? Because the world's way of putting things forward is, in order to be important, the world has to deem it important. But that's not true. We know that one thing that's always important in Scripture is a cup of cold water in my name. No matter where God's put you, no matter what you're doing, if you're doing things His way, you're following in the line of David, the servant king. God, thank you for this amazing promise that you've given us. I pray that you help us have eyes to see. We don't have to fight the world the world's way. We can fight it your way. And if we do, it can't stand. And we have this amazing opportunity to be servant kings. And the reward you've promised us, if we'll do it, is beyond anything we can imagine. I pray that you'll help us embrace this, see it, live it. In Jesus' name, amen.